You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, November 18th. I'm Oliver Stevenson from Drake University. Here is our first story. Starting out, we have a photograph led by the Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce Workforce Development Director Alicia Fries. She speaks during an event at Iowa Western Community College announcing Pottawatomi County's certification as an ACT work-ready community on Tuesday, November 16th. We start with the headline, Putting in Hard Work, Pottawatomi County Now a Work-Ready Community. Pottawatomi County officials are celebrating certification as an ACT work-ready community. According to local stakeholders, the initiative empowers states, regions, and counties with data, processes, and tools that drive economic growth by identifying skill gaps and quantifying the skill level of their workforce. Over 120 businesses in Pottawatomi County have already shown support for ACTWRC. ACT said the county has demonstrated its commitment to developing a strong workforce pipeline desirable to employers, economic developers, and current and future citizens of the county. We now have a lot of resources available to us because we are certified through ACT, said Alicia Fries, Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce Workforce Development Director, at a celebration held Tuesday at Iowa Western Community College. Pottawatomi County leaders met with local employers, policymakers, educators, and economic developers to establish goals and build a sustainable WRC model to fit community needs, according to a release on the designation. We are very, very happy that this is happening, said Drew Camp, Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce President and CEO. We have public, we have private, we have nonprofit. They all have a role to play. They all need to be at the table. We can't leave people out because they all have something to bring to bear. Another piece that community leaders have been working on is the National Career Readiness Certificate, which is a credential that certifies the essential skills for workplace success. Abraham Lincoln High School now requires that every student out of high school get their NCRC, a valid predictor of job performance that employers can use. Congratulations to Pottawatomi for becoming an ACT work-ready community and joining a growing list of counties dedicated to building a robust workforce. ACT Regional Manager of Workforce Initiatives Tony Garif said in the release. The efforts of the county leadership to achieve WRC certification will provide the community with a tremendous economic development advantage and help it stand out for its workforce development efforts. For more information, visit workreadycommunities.org. Continuing with the local news, we have the headline, Dear Union Ratifies Contract by Kara Smith. Kara Smith of the Quad City Times writes, the UAW has voted to ratify the latest offer from Deere & Company ending the strike. Other than minor changes to Deere's continuous improvement pay program, the company's third offer presented the same benefits as a second agreement turned away November 2nd by 55-45% vote, with locals from some Quad City Union locals, but rejection from shops in Waterloo and Dubuque. This time, union members approved the deal overwhelmingly, 61%-39%. At Davenport Water Works, the contract was ratified 77%-23%. John C. May, chairman and CEO for Deere, said in a press release that together, workers and the company have a bright future. I'm pleased our highly skilled employees are back to work building and supporting the industry-leading products, which make our customers more profitable and sustainable, May said. John Deere's success depends on the success of our people. The ratification vote marks the end of a strike that captured the mood of a nation in search of better benefits, said Brian Rothenberg, spokesperson for the UAW, in a press release. UAW John Deere members did not just unite themselves. They seemed to unite the nation in a struggle for fairness in the workplace, said UAW President Ray Curry in the release. We could not be more proud of these UAW members and their families. The six-year contract covers about 10,100 production and maintenance employees at 12 facilities in Iowa, Illinois, and Kansas. With the ratification of a new agreement, workers are expected to return to their jobs. Workers should consult with their local union representatives to see whether they report back to work on Thursday morning or later this week, Rothenberg said. On the UAW 281 local Facebook page, it reads, "Company will contact you on when to report to work." Jen Hartman, spokesperson for Deere, said she was informed operations will resume this evening for a third shift. UAD Local 79 union members from John Deere Parts Distribution Center streamed out of the Camden Center in Milan on Wednesday afternoon after voting on the latest agreement. Many workers stepped out of the building holding masks and flyers about the potential contract. Some workers congregated outside of the building to talk and smoke with one another about potentially returning to work. Other workers got into cars with UAW Local 79 bumper stickers and messages of union solidarity painted on their rear windows. Despite casting their votes and standing in solidarity with the outcome of the ratification votes, Quad City union members acknowledged that they were just a small portion of the plants and their potential outcomes. "We are just along for the ride," said one worker at John Deere Seating Group in Moline. The total number of employees across the four Quad Cities John Deere facilities is 3,950, according to the company. John Deere Waterloo Works alone has 3,317 employees, with the plants in Ankeny and Dubuque employing 2,290 people combined. Workers across locals said that tensions were rising ahead of the Wednesday vote and that they expected this vote to also have a narrow margin. A union member from Davenport Works said he'd vote against the contract, but predicted many others to vote differently. "It's just kind of sad to me because there are people I know who voted no last time solidly with intelligent reasons why they waited it out," the worker said. "I already know they're going to vote yes this time just to suddenly go back to work." Continuing with the local news, we have the headline, "Winterfest is Friday" by Mike Brownlee. Council Bluffs Winterfest will be held from 5:30 to 8 p.m. on Friday. The city noted it will again partner with the Council Bluffs Public Library, the 712 Initiative, Union Pacific Museum, and Potawatomi Arts, Culture, and Entertainment to hold the Council Bluffs holiday tradition. Organizers canceled Winterfest in 2020 because of the COVID-19 pandemic, but there was a light display at the Bayless Park and a holiday lights tour. The main event at the Winterfest is the Bayless Park lighting ceremony. At 6:30 p.m., Santa Claus and Mayor Walsh lead the crowd in a song of jingle bells, followed by a countdown, after which Bayless Park is illuminated with more than 40,000 twinkle lights. The 2021 Winterfest merriments include the traditional favorites plus a few new additions. The Council Bluffs Public Library is bringing real reindeer into Bayless Park and offering reindeer-themed arts, crafts, and literacy festivities. Also new is a live ice sculpture demonstration presented by Pace, and for the first time, the Union Pacific Museum is lighting its building with a festive display and gifting light-up jewelry to kids. The 712 Initiative is hosting the Maker's Village again, offering the opportunity to shop unique handmade holiday gifts from local vendors in a pop-up market on Pearl Street. Food trucks will be present with concessions available for purchase. Thanks to the Salvation Army, free hot chocolates will be available. Traditional festivities include live music from the Salvation Army Brass Ensemble, traveling Dickens carolers, an outdoor screening of a holiday classic, balloon art, face painting, crafts, and several jolly photo ops. All Winterfest activities are free to the public. Items from the food truck and Maker's Village will be available for purchase. Find the Winterfest at Bayless Park event on Facebook at City of CB. We are then provided a photo of past Winterfest with Santa Claus with the caption, Santa Claus right and Mayor Walsh left. Chat with the crowd after the holiday lights at Bayless Park were turned on during Winterfest on Thursday, November 21st, 2019. Continuing with local news, we have the headline, LC Superintendent Survey Update. District sees good response. Survey ends Friday, by Tim Johnson. Lewis Central Community School District is seeing strong participation in its survey on what people want in a superintendent. Current Superintendent Eric Nost plans to resign at the end of the school year. Responses to the survey posted November 5th are running ahead of what they were 3 years ago when the district was launching a superintendent search. Lewis Central Board of Education President Doreen Scheffel said during the board's meeting Monday. Looking at what we have right now compared to 3 years ago, support staff is up a few. Teachers are up a few, administrators are down a few, and parents are up 100, she told board members. Responses from the community are about the same, she said. The online survey, which closes Friday, will help board members create a profile of the desired superintendent candidate. There's a link to the survey on the district website. To find it, visit lewiscentral.org and click on the What's Happening headline, Superintendent Search Survey. Candidates' applications will be accepted until January 2nd, and will be screened by search firm Grundmeier Leader Services, which will also share materials with the board. Members will meet in a closed session on January 10th to review applications and choose 8 semi-finalists to be interviewed via video conference in another closed session on January 17th. Finalists will be interviewed in person on January 24th, with January 31st as the snow date. A committee that includes representatives from district, faculty, staff, and others, as well as members of the board, will be formed to conduct the interviews, Scheffel said. The board hopes to have a new superintendent hired by the end of January. In other business, the board approved applications to the school budget review for the following. A modified supplemental amount of $1,464 for the limited English instructional program, a modified supplemental amount of $134,422 due to an increase in a certified enrollment from last year, a modified supplemental amount of $390,452 for students open enrolled out who were not included in the district's certified enrollment count last year. Lastly, with a modified supplemental amount of $27,679 related to the English Language Learner Program for students who have exceeded 5 years of waiting that are included in the fall of 2021 certified enrollment headcount. If the requests are granted, the school district would receive additional spending authority, not funding. It would need to levy cash reserves to cover this authority if more cash was needed. Continuing with the front page news, we have Rittenhouse lawyers asked judge to declare mistrial over video with the image of Kyle Rittenhouse with the caption, Kyle Rittenhouse looks back before going on a break Monday during his trial at the Kenosha County Courthouse in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Rittenhouse is charged with shooting 3 people, killing 2 of them, at a protest last year against police brutality by Michael Tarm, Scott Bauer, Amy Forlitti, and Deneen Smith with Associated Press and the Kenosha News. From Kenosha, Wisconsin, jury deliberations in the Kyle Rittenhouse murder trial are stretching into a third day, even as his attorneys asked the judge to declare a mistrial Wednesday, saying the defense received an inferior copy of a potentially crucial video from prosecutors. Judge Bruce Schroeder did not immediately rule on the request, the second mistrial motion from the defense in a week. The jury deliberated a second full day without reaching a verdict and will return Thursday morning. As they considered the case Wednesday, jurors asked to review several videos shown during the trial that captured Rittenhouse shooting three men, killing two, on August 25, 2020. During the unrest that unfolded in Kenosha after a black man, Jacob Blake, was shot by a white police officer. At issue was a piece of drone footage prosecutors showed to the jury in closing arguments in a bid to undermine Rittenhouse's self-defense claim and portray him as the one who set in motion the bloodshed in Kenosha last year. Prosecutors said the footage showed him pointing his rifle at protesters before the shooting erupted. Rittenhouse attorney Corey Schifrezzi said the defense would have done this case in a little bit of a different manner if they had the same higher quality video used by the prosecution and is now asking for a level fair playing field. Schifrezzi said the mistrial request would be made without prejudice, meaning prosecutors could still retry Rittenhouse. There is already a pending motion from the defense for a mistrial with prejudice, meaning Rittenhouse could not be put on trial again. That motion is based on what the defense said were improper questions asked by prosecutor Thomas Binger during his cross-examination of Rittenhouse and also includes an objection to the drone video. Rittenhouse, 18, is on trial on homicide and attempted homicide charges for killing two men and wounding a third with an AR-style semi-automatic rifle during a tumultuous night of protests. Rittenhouse, then a 17-year-old former police youth cadet, said he went to Kenosha to protect property from rioters. He shot and killed Joseph Rosenbaum, 36, and Anthony Huber, 26, and wounded Gage Grosskreutz, now 28. Rittenhouse is white as those shot. The case has become a flashpoint in the debate over guns, racial injustice, vigilantism, and self-defense in the U.S. Rittenhouse, who has maintained he acted in self-defense, could get life in prison if convicted of the most serious charge against him. The dispute over the video erupted after the jurors asked to rewatch footage on day two of their deliberations. Defense attorneys said they would object to the jury viewing the drone video. The same footage prompted heated dispute earlier in the trial over technical questions of whether a still image taken from the video was distorted when it was enlarged. The state believes the video was inadvertently compressed by email software when it was transferred to the defense, but pointed out that Rittenhouse's former attorney, John Pierce, appeared to have had a copy of the same video shortly after the shooting. I understand this is different attorneys now, but the defendant's attorney knew about it 3 days after the incident and was talking about it on national television, Kenosha County Assistant District Attorney Jim Krause said of the video. Schroeder moved the attorneys back to the question of how the jurors could review the video. They asked to see while deliberating, but Schroeder warned the state could have difficulty because they had relied heavily on evidence now in dispute. I think I warned you the other day that you're putting a lot of emphasis on this, and if it turns out to not be technically sound, I think I refer to it as, in parentheses, falling like, close parentheses, a house of cards, Schroeder said. The prosecution contends the video proves Rittenhouse lied on the stand when he said he didn't point his rifle at protesters, but the key moment in the video is hard to decipher because of how far away the drone was and how small a figure Rittenhouse is in the frame. Prosecutors told the judge that the jury saw the highest quality version during the trial and that it was not the state's fault that the file size got smaller when received by the defense. The judge said he had qualms about admitting the video during the trial, but because it had already been shown in court, he would allow the jury to rewatch it during deliberations. Schroeder said the mistrial request will have to be addressed if there is a guilty verdict. If Rittenhouse is acquitted, the issue will be moot. But if he is found guilty, a mistrial ruling would essentially void the verdict. Julius Kim, a Milwaukee-based defense attorney who has been watching the case, said a mistrial could be declared even if the judge finds it was an honest mistake or a technical problem. But to win a mistrial, the defense will have to meet a high bar and explain to the judge why what happened actually hurt Rittenhouse, said Ion Main, an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Earlier in the day, the judge criticized news coverage of the case and second-guessing from legal experts and the media, saying he would think long and hard about allowing televised trials in the future. He took exception to news stories about his decisions not to allow the men Rittenhouse shot to be called victims and to let Rittenhouse draw the lots that determined which jurors were alternates. The judge also complained about criticism that he had yet to rule on the earlier mistrial request. Schroeder said he hadn't had a chance to read the motion because he had just received it and wanted to give the state a chance to weigh in. For the face of the day, we have Pottawatomie County Community Foundation concludes the National Community Foundation Week celebration by sharing the story of an agency partnership that is creating a powerful impact. Agency funds at PCCF are a simple and efficient way to build an endowment that will help create sustainability for an organization while providing dollars to meet agency needs. Amanda LeBeck, director of the Walnut Community Center, and her board of directors decided to help an account with the PCCF to help build a sustainable plan for the future of the center. By creating the fund, they hope to ensure long-term financial stability for the center by building assets for a flexible, unrestricted funding option for future projects and operations. The Walnut Community Center has also received community impact grants from PCCF to support its mission. Community impact grants from PCCF have been a huge benefit to the Walnut Community Center, Amanda said. This year's is not the first PCCF community impact grant. However, that the community center has leveraged toward progress and achieving community goals. The grants have allowed us to start and finish projects sooner than we expected, Amanda said. They have also helped the Walnut Community Center get more publicity as well as support from the PCCF staff. The Community Foundation assisted us with three major projects, Amanda said. The first project was starting our wellness center. We were able to purchase commercial-grade fitness equipment and convert two classrooms into a wellness center. Currently, we have 60 active memberships and are serving 136 people in our community. The second project was the purchase and installation of basketball hoop extenders to help members of the Walnut Wellness Center use these hoops more easily. Members use them every day, as do our Little League teams from the AHSTW School District. This year's grant of $5,000 helped us install handicap accessible doors throughout the wellness facility and will help folks of all abilities access the center with ease. PCCF works with individuals, families, businesses, nonprofits, and governmental entities to establish endowment funds and other philanthropic solutions that will benefit the community for further generations. To learn more about PCCF and agency funds, visit rpccf.org. For the weather forecast, temperatures will hover in the 40s and 50s for much of the next week. The high today will be around 42, with wind speeds up to 22 miles per hour, according to the National Weather Service. Morning temps will be in the 30s before hitting the high around 3 p.m. The low tonight is 28. Dry conditions will continue through early next week, the Weather Service said. The high on Friday is around 49, with wind speeds up to 31 miles per hour. The wind dies down somewhat in the evening, thankfully, but the low will be around 33. Winterfest activities in Council Bluffs will run from 5:30 to 8 p.m. at Bayless Park. The high Saturday is around 53 with a low of 34. Honoring veterans, we have an image of Vince Keneally of Council Bluffs, served in the Air Force where he rose to the rank of Staff Sergeant. Keneally died in June of 1973. Harold E. Allen of Council Bluffs served in the Army where he was a private first class. He died in 2017, followed by a picture of Mr. Allen and his three dogs. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, November 18th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Oliver Stevenson from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this one or any IRIS program, please call toll-free anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. For the opinion piece, Southwest Iowa CASA Reflects on National Adoption Month by Ann Christensen. November is National Adoption Month, and Southwest Iowa CASA program is celebrating and supporting the many families in our community who have welcomed a child into their home through adoption, with a special spotlight on adoption by relatives. When we think about adoption from foster care, many of us think of it in terms of adoption by a non-relative. What we don't all realize, however, is that adoption can take many forms. It's also quite common for a child to be adopted by or live with a relative or family friend. Often, when a child cannot safely go back home with their parents, then their grandparents, aunts, uncles, and other family members step up to care for them. This is known in the system as kinship care. In some cases, children live with family friends, coaches, teachers, or mentors, which is called fictive kin. Keeping children with people they know is what CASA volunteers and professionals in the system strive for, because it helps keep them connected with their community, culture, and loved ones. CASA volunteers are everyday citizens from the community who are screened and trained and appointed by a judge to advocate for a child's best interests in court. They work collaboratively with the professionals on the child's case, including the caseworker, attorneys, and others. Their top priority is to advocate for the child to reunify with their parents whenever safe and possible. When this is not an option, they advocate for the child to live with and be adopted by other family members, friends, or with a caring adoptive family. This season of Thanksgiving, CASA volunteers are thankful for those who give each child a permanent and unconditionally loving home where they can heal and grow. For more information on the work of CASA volunteers and to get involved, inquire at CASA.org or 712-328-4811. For today's records and obituaries, Rose Marie L. Wingert, age 93, of Avoca, Iowa, passed away November 16th, 2021 in Avoca. Rosemarie Loretta Wingert was born May 6, 1928 in Panama, Iowa, to the late Herman and Christina, maiden name Mum, Freud. She was baptized at St. Mary Catholic Church in Panama and attended school there as well. Rosemarie took a job working for Raymond and Viatora Wingert, and it was there that she met and fell in love with Ray's brother, Anthony Tony. And Tony and Rose were married on a cold and snowy day at St. Mary's Church, Panama, on April 12th, 1951. Rosemarie participated in many capacities in the church, was on the parish council, and in the choir. She was an avid quilter, hand-sewing quilts for the bazaar, and she made baby quilts for babies baptized as part of the Family Life Council. She was a member of St. Mary's Catholic Church in Avoca, member of the Pioneer Country Club, belonged to neighborhood card parties, and enjoyed dancing with Tony. In addition to her parents, Rosemary preceded in death by her daughters Christina in 1970, Marilyn Ford in 2021, son Neil in 2010, sister Agnes, Jacob maiden name, Haystert, brothers Harold, Joseph, and Ralph. Rosemary is survived by her daughters Sue Ellen Mills of La Junta, Colorado, Sarah Schmidt of Fremont, Nebraska, sons Larry of Avoca, and John of Shelby. Seven grandchildren, eight great-grandchildren, daughter-in-law, Jan Wingert of Shelby, son-in-law, Clint Ford of Brush, Colorado, many nieces and nephews. Recitation of the Rosary, Friday, 4:30 p.m., followed by visitation with the family until 7 p.m. at St. Mary's Catholic Church, Avoca, Iowa. Mass of Christian burial, Saturday at 10:30 a.m. at St. Mary's Church, followed by lunch in the parish hall. Burial will follow in St. Mary's Cemetery, Portsmouth, Iowa. Memorials are suggested to St. Mary's Church in Avoca or Mass for the shut-ins. May she rest in peace. Moving to the sports section, IWCC advances to semifinals. Iowa Western Soccer wins group play. Sophomore forward Arata Segusa secured the lone goal in a 1-0 victory for number 3 Iowa Western men's soccer in a win over number 6 Laramie County on Wednesday in Tyler, Texas during the national tournament. The goal not only led to a Reaver victory, but secured IWCC a spot in the semifinals. Segusa's goal came in the 46th minute after a scoreless first half. "It's one of those where you win in advance," head coach Mike Brown said. "It wasn't beautiful, it wasn't pretty, but we kind of just put it together and figured it out. We just grinded and survived and advanced." Segusa's goal came off a corner kick from sophomore midfielder Giorgio Probo. The ball bounced around, but Segusa finally placed it in the back of the net. "It was one of those things. It was just a ball bouncing around, and he just tapped it back in," Brown said. "We've been working on set pieces a lot this work. We just haven't been getting consistent play, goal scoring from our forwards. The others say our forwards were on. They haven't been consistent, so we spent a lot of times on set pieces. Because of that, I felt it was a great moment, and we got it in." Laramie County finished the match with 6 shots, 4 of which were on goal, and Iowa Western finished with 7 total chances, 4 of which were on target. Laramie goalkeeper Declan Domian came up with 3 saves, and Iowa Western sophomore goalkeeper Yuta Ishizuka stopped all 4 balls that came his way. "Yuta was great, managed the game well," Brown said. "We had moments where he didn't manage as well, but he did a good job, and I thought it was a great game from him." The Rivers tallied 2 corner kicks compared to 4 for the Golden Eagles. IWCC also committed 4 fouls compared to just 1 for Laramie. Iowa Western will play the winner between number 4 Tyler and number 5 Iowa Lakes at 5:30 p.m. on Friday. "We're on to the next," Brown said. "We have to get healthy. It will be interesting." Next, late goal ends Reaver's season. Iowa Western women's soccer saw its season end in the NJCAA Division I National Tournament on Wednesday in Daytona Beach after Salt Lake scored a goal in the 83rd minute in a 1-0 victory. The IWCC Reavers outshot the Bruins 10-9 and had one more shot on goal, but couldn't sneak any past the goalkeeper. "I thought we played well," head coach Adam Sanchez said. "I thought we played good enough to get a result. We just couldn't find the back of the net. When you don't take your chances and you don't find the back of the net against good teams, it comes back and gets you. I thought the effort, I thought they were smart, they were intelligent, and they went after them. I couldn't be prouder of them. Iowa Western needed to win by 2 goals to advance to the semifinals, so they opened up the offense late, leading to the Bruins scoring on a counterattack. We need to gamble, so we sent some numbers forward, Sanchez said. It was a really good goal. We tried to push forward at the end to try to create some more chances and try to get a goal before the 10-minute mark. Iowa redshirt sophomore goalkeeper Judy Golovaris stopped one of Salt Lake's 2 scoring opportunities. Freshman midfielder Marie Quintel took 4 of the Reavers' shots and was responsible for 2 of the shots on goal. Salt Lake had the advantage in corner kicks 5-3. The Bruins committed 14 fouls compared to just 8 for the Reavers. Salt Lake's approach in every game is the same, Sanchez said. They didn't change anything. They're very pragmatic. They don't take a lot of risks. That's just who they are. I wouldn't say they parked the bus, but they played really conservative, and then they'd look to get a goal or 2 goals. That's part of their game plan. They played us straight us. They played us the way we expected them to play. I think we played really well to keep them on the back foot. We just couldn't find the back of the net. Despite ending their season, Sanchez said he is proud of the season Iowa Western had. I think that's the downside of competing for Iowa Western, he said. You always have lofty goals, and the risk of failure is really, really high. I think it's important for us to remember and look back that we do things that no other team in the country does, except for the elite in the country. We can look back at the season and know that we hit a few milestones, and we have to make sure that we don't lose sight of that. It's a special group. They did special things, and they had a really fantastic season. Council Bluffs All-City Volleyball. The Daily Nonpareil, with the help of the Inner City Coaches, presents the 2021 All-City Volleyball Team. After going the farthest in the postseason, the Titans landed 3 players on our list after making it all the way to the regional final game before falling to Sioux City Helan in 4 sets. Tied with the Titans is the St. Albert Saints with 3 players of their own as they made it to the regional semifinal before closing their season. The Abraham Lincoln Lynx got 2 of their girls on the team after an impressive postseason run that ended in Urbandale and just 1 game away from the state tournament. Finally, Thomas Jefferson earned a girl on the team as well after falling in the first round of the postseason. Listed below is the 2021 All-City Volleyball Team as well as some honorable mentions. First Team, Lauren Williams, St. Albert, a senior. Williams was a force in many areas for the Saints as she led St. Albert with 253 kills, 74 blocks, and 69 assists. Williams was second on the team in digs with 234 and second in aces with 36 on the season. Williams was also named a unanimous first-time Hawkeye 10 conference selection. Lauren was our top player on the team, playing 6 rotations and a primary passer on serve-receive, Saints coach Angie Lance said. Maddie Bergman, Lewis Central, Jr. Bergman led the Titans with 234 kills with a .298 efficiency. The junior also led the team with 72 blocks and contributed 53 digs. Maddie is a strong offensive threat along with strong blocking skills. Many teams had to account for her as a factor in our success, Titans coach Mike Blond said. Carly Brown, Lewis Central, a senior. Brown was a key setter for the Titans with a team-high 471 assists and also put down 16 kills. Brown also pitched in 171 digs and 38 aces. Carly has been a great 4-year starter for us. She has great decision-making skills as to where to set the ball. She also has excellent defensive skills to complement her setting skills, Bond said. Faith Christensen, Thomas Jefferson, a senior. The team captain was a setter who could do a little bit of everything for the Yellow Jackets. Christensen led TJ with 309 assists and had 31 kills and 4 blocks as well. Christensen was second on the team with 190 digs and led the team with 25 serving aces. Faith was a great team leader who moved to the setter position this season from libero last year. TJ head coach Darian White. Bailey Gears, Abraham Lincoln, a senior. Gears was a 4-year starter for the Lynx. This season, Gears had 304 blocks, 304 kills with 0.295 efficiency, 283 digs, and 70 blocks. Gears in her career had 803 kills, 305 blocks, and 734 digs. Bay is an amazing athlete who has proven she can play anywhere on the court and would be a stud on any team throughout the state, Lynx coach Katie Darrington said. Landry Miller, St. Albert, a junior. Miller led the team in digs with 325 and served 90% on the year with 23 ace serves. Landry was our libero, whose defense and serve receive improved over the course of the season, Lance said. Allison Narmi, St. Albert, a senior. The senior was a second-team Hawkeye 10 conference selection, second on the team in kills with 189 and hit .33 on the year, and she was second on the team in blocks with 61 total. Allison was one of our workhorses for the season, and her play improved as the season went on, Lance said. Molly Romano, Abraham Lincoln, a sophomore. As a sophomore, Romano impressed many teams with 822 assists, 157 kills, and a .376 efficiency, and 250 digs. Mo can do it all, Darrington said. She is an amazing setter who pushes herself to get better every day, arguably one of the best setters in the state. And lastly, Anna Strohmeyer, Lewis Central, a sophomore. The sophomore had 7 solo blocks, 56 assisted blocks, 211 digs, 217 kills with a .245 efficiency, and 33 aces. Anna was a 6 rotation player for us. She was solid in all phases of the game, Bond said. The honorable mentions include Azaria Green from Abraham Lincoln, a junior, Jenna Carl, also from Abraham Lincoln, a junior, Lydia Dix, Abraham Lincoln, a freshman, Hudson Rao, Abraham Lincoln, also a freshman, Maddie Junt, Heartland Christian, a junior, Grace Heffernan, Heartland Christian, a junior, Emma Brown, Heartland Christian, a freshman, McKenna McCord, Heartland Christian, a sophomore, Addison Holt, Lewis Central, a sophomore, Anna Galls, Lewis Central, a senior, Gracie Hayes, Lewis Central, a junior, Maddie Horvath, St. Albert's, a senior, Lainey Sheffield, St. Albert, also a senior, Braylon Keys, Thomas Jefferson, a junior, Samara Alcaraz, Thomas Jefferson, also a junior, and Jaslyn Sanders, Thomas Jefferson, a senior. Next, we have TJ holds high hopes with a photo of the bowlers competing. Thomas, with the caption, Thomas Jefferson's Marissa Bird, right, rolls during the Intra-Cities Triangular Meet between the Yellow Jackets, Lewis Central, and St. Albert at Thunder Bowl on Thursday, January 21st, 2021. There is a lot of high hopes for the Thomas Jefferson bowling teams entering the 2021 season after returning many bowlers of the squad from a successful 2020 campaign. One new piece to the puzzle is head coach Matt Young, who is in his first year at the program. Right now, we are pretty optimistic about the upcoming season and what we should be able to accomplish as a team, Young said. As the new bowling coach, I am excited about the opportunity to lead our team to success and teach our bowlers lifelong skills such as effort, perseverance, and teamwork. I'm also looking forward to building new relationships with my players and other coaches. According to Varsity Bound, last year the boys' team went 3-3 in duels, with wins over Sergeant Bluff, Lutton, Sioux City West, and Sioux City East. Their three losses came to Abraham Lincoln, Sioux City North, and Red Oak. The played 2-1 tournament, 3rd in the conference tournament, and 4th in the holiday tournament and city tournament. TJ returned seniors Samuel Shano and Eli Dross and sophomore Mullen Bryant. Shano's best game was 209 and his best set was 369. The girls team went 2-4 in duels with wins over Sioux City West and Sioux City East. Their four losses came to Abraham Lincoln, Sioux City North, Sergeant Bluff Lutton, and Red Oak. The girls placed 7th in the holiday tournament, 4th in the city tournament, 3rd at regionals, and 2nd in the one other tournament they competed in. The girls' team will have plenty of experience with 5 seniors: Marissa Bird, Faith Christensen, Mackenzie Harstad, Trinity Meyer, and Riley Rich, and 2 juniors, Chastity Britton, Talitha Dross. Bird bowled the high game and high set for Thomas Jefferson last season. Her high game was 196 and her high set was 363. Looking at the scores from last season, the team bowled pretty solid throughout the season and played well in many of the tournaments they competed in, Young said. Our goals for the season are that we get better each and every time we have the opportunity to step on the lanes and that we become a little more consistent each and every time we compete. If we could consistently increase our pinfall by 5 to 10 pins a competition, I think the team would be pretty happy about where they would be at the end of the season. Young also added that he will be looking to the returning players to help lead the team. I would expect our older, experienced bowlers to be the leaders this season, but I have also heard through the grapevine that we have some strong bowlers coming in as well. We'll just have to see how our team shapes up after a couple of weeks. Thomas Jefferson starts its season at 3:30 p.m. on November 29th in a home duel against Abraham Lincoln at Thunder Bowl. Next, St. Albert plans to avoid heartbreak. St. Albert Bowling has faced heartbreak its last 2 seasons on the boys' side, twice in a row. St. Albert Boys Bowling has bowled the 6th best score in the state at the state qualifying meet, but lost to a top 5 score and been left out by 1 spot. St. Albert hopes to change that this year with an experienced roster and also hopes to qualify its girls team that is loaded with sophomore talent. It's really exciting to be back out on the lanes with the kids, head coach Mike Klusman said. Watching them get the first week of practice in, it's going to be a really competitive season on our boys team for sure. Hoping to overcome the results of the last 2 years for the boys are key bowlers like Evan White, who was one of the top bowlers in the area last year. This summer, White has bowled 2 300 games. Me personally, I wanted to make it to state, Klusman said. If you look back at it, now it was a great season, but in my mind, we came up short. We were one of the best teams in the state, and Clarinda showed up that day, and they stuck it to us. There's really nothing you can do. We did everything that we thought we needed to do to advance. It's just the way the cookie crumbles. We have motivation to get better and make sure that doesn't happen. Other key bowlers on the boys' side include Adam Denny, Jackson Whittington, Hayden Pisorski, Reese Peckney, and Cole Peckney. The girls saw their top bowler from last year transfer out, but have a lot of young talent that Klusman hopes can fill that hole. The girls finished 4th in conference last year. I want the girls to make it to state, Klusman said. I think it's an achievable goal. It's going to take hard work. Year it's not going to become easy. Nothing comes easy. The girls are putting in the effort and work at the end of the day. We have 8 to 10 weeks to get them mentally and physically ready to do something St. Albert has never done yet, believe it or not. The season will start at 3 p.m. on November 29th at Clarinda. LC Bowling hopes to succeed. Lewis Central Bowling faced a roller coaster of a year last season with COVID complications affecting large portions of the season. Despite dealing with adversity, the Titans achieved a high level of success. Last season was filled with highs and lows, head coach Paul Renshaw said. COVID ran through our team from the beginning of the year all the way up to the end of the season. Going into the season, I wasn't sure what our team would look like due to COVID. Once we started signups and practice, it was clear we were going to be missing some athletes that would have been big contributors for our season. Like many other activities, we were short some athletes due to the pandemic. All in all, we maneuvered our way through and ended the season short of where we wanted to be. Lewis Central returns many key bowlers this season and hopes to pick up where it left off last year. In 2020, the Titan boys went W1 in duels and placed second at multiple tournaments, including its holiday tournament and the city tournament. The girls also went 4-1, won the city championship, and placed first at two triangular. Now that there seems to be somewhat of a grip on the whole COVID pandemic, I'm feeling really good about both teams this upcoming season, Renshaw said. Caleb Holt Walker and Max Thompson both will be bowling boys varsity, and Alexandria AJ Ford, also a freshman, will be bowling on the girls varsity. All three should be big contributors to this year's team. Other key bowlers include Addie Murray, Faith Renshaw, Sophia Klopenstein, Alicia Odin, AJ Schlitz, and Huner Mursick. Given the returning talent, Lewis Central is setting many of the same goals it sets every year. Some of those goals include winning the city tournament and the Hawk 10, and hopefully qualifying for state. Our goals and expectations for this season are really no different than any other season. Our first tournament of the season is the holiday tournament, which is usually a good indicator of how the rest of the season will go. The end of the season this year is going to be different from years past, as we will be competing in 3A for both districts and state. It will be exciting to see how well we match up with some of the best teams in the state of Iowa. Overall, I believe we will be a top competitor in the regular season and the postseason. After this season is all said and done, our hope is that we will add another banner to the gym wall and one more state trophy to our trophy case. Last, we have Abraham Lincoln Bowling, Ise State. Abraham Lincoln Bowling may be under new management as first-year head coach Caitlin Morris takes over, but the Lynx are setting their goals just as high as ever with the state tournament circled on the calendar. Morris is still waiting to see how many returning bowlers she'll have off last year's squad, but knows the ones that are coming back want to make a run in the postseason. This upcoming season should be a good one, Morris said. Our returning athletes are excited for the season to start and have already stated that we're making it to state. I know our bowlers have a lot of skill and I can't wait to see how we do this year. Last season, the Lynx bowling team had one of our varsity boys go to state for individuals. This year, our goal is to go as a team. I can see that there's a passion for bowling for these kids and a drive to be better than the day before. Some of the key bowlers that Morris said she has high goals for include seniors McKenna Reithmeyer and Gabriella Peterson, and juniors Eric McCoy and Bennett Olson. Freshman Carter Schwieslow is another bowler the Lynx are anticipating to have a good season. Abraham Lincoln will start the season at 3:30 p.m. on November 29th against Thomas Jefferson at Thunderbowl. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, November 18th, 2021. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Oliver Stevenson from Drake University in Des Moines, Thank you for listening and have a good day.
Are you among the millions of Americans living with chronic pain? If so, you may think prescription opioids are the solution. The truth is, the benefits of opioids are limited. Opioids only mask the pain. Opioids also come with serious side effects, ranging from nausea to withdrawal symptoms to overdose. As many as 25% of people who are prescribed opioids struggle with addiction. And those who are addicted to opioids are 40 times more likely to move on to heroin. No one wants to live in pain, but no one should put their health at risk to be pain-free. There is another choice, physical therapy. Physical therapists treat pain through movement and exercise, no warning labels required, and you get to be an active participant in your care. Choose to treat your pain safely. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist near you. This public service announcement is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.